have the tree business attended to, and still have plenty of time to talk with River before the late news. Pete kissed me, wished me a good day, and said he'd watch my debut, then come over to my place with champagne to celebrate. He had to work Friday, but had managed to get Saturday and Sunday off, so we had a weekend to look forward to. I filled Orion's red bowl with kibble, then sat at the table going over my notes for the show. I had my crow facts straight, I was sure, and the Society had provided plenty of history on crow invasions, similar to the ones Salem had just experienced. It happened more often than I'd supposed, and a murder of crows was a much more common expression among birders than I'd imagined. I decided that it had a cool ring to it, and decided to use the term frequently during the broadcast. I just added the addresses for Gloria and her neighbor to my notes when my phone buzzed. I was surprised to see a text from River. What's she doing up so early? I got the answer to that right away. She hadn't gone to bed yet. Apparently, Buck Covington had been on hand to observe the electric blue sequin gorgeousness, and they'd stayed up talking all night, and she was finally about to get some sleep. She didn't mention the whispering caller. I didn't either. Maybe she hadn't talked with Therese yet. Probably a long talk with Buck was more interesting than finding out what some nut job wanted anyway. I wished her good luck and happiness, and resolved to watch the noon news to see if the river-smitten announcer was still letter-perfect in his delivery. The phone immediately buzzed again, and thinking River had more to tell me, I answered without looking at the caller ID. It was Sean Madigan.
"Good morning, Ms. Barrett. So glad to speak to you in person. This is Sean Madigan, Dakota Berman's best man. Got a minute?"
Sure. Sorry I haven't had a chance to return your earlier call. Been crazy busy."
"I understand. Thought maybe if you have time I'd drop by and take you to breakfast. Get acquainted."
His tone was pleasant. Impersonal, really.
"Shannon thought it would be a good idea for us to meet before the wedding."
"Well, I guess."
"Nothing fancy. Come as you are."
I could detect a smile in his voice. Or was it a smirk? It's hard to tell over the phone.
"Thought we'd just go to the diner that's attached to your school. I'll ask the kids to join us if you can make it."
The kids? I guessed he meant Shannon and Dakota. My mind was racing. Go to some public place, Aunt Ibby had advised. The diner would qualify.
"Come as you are," the man said. I looked down at my shorts and shirt. All right for a warm spring day in Salem.
"Okay," I heard myself say. "I'll meet you there. What time?"
"How's right now? I hoped you'd say yes, so I'm parked in front of your house."
None of my windows face Winter Street, so I couldn't confirm his statement. But I believed him. What nerve! My annoyance was undoubtedly obvious. "That's taking a lot for granted, Mr. Madigan," I said. "How do you know where I live, anyway?"
"Shannon gave me your address. I guess I'm just too impulsive."
Smiley voice again.
"It's such a nice day, I thought it would be fun. Spontaneous, you know? Please don't be angry."
The voice was softer now, appropriately little boy repentant. What a con man! I felt my temper rising. I don't do the temper thing on purpose, and it doesn't happen often. I've been told it's a redhead thing. Aunt Ibby says she has it too, although I've only seen hers on display once or twice in my whole life. Anyway, there it was. Full-on, redhead, ice-cold, I'll show you, you smarmy bastard, fury. "I'll be right down," I said. I hung up, slid my feet into flip-flops, jammed a Guy Harvey visor cap over wild hair, slapped on some pink lip gloss, and, without even a kind word or goodbye pat on the head for my surprised cat, headed out of my kitchen and down the stairs to the Winter Street front door. I thought about taking my own car for 2 seconds, but that would just be chickening out. A smiling Sean Madigan stood on the curb, holding open the passenger door of a green 2010 Toyota Corolla. I returned the smile with a teeth-gritting grimace of my own and slid into the car, noting that there was bird poop on the roof, even though the crows had been gone for a couple of days. Not bad looking, but still a crook and a con man and a slob, too.
"Hi there," he said. "Happy to finally meet you. You're even prettier than you look on TV."
"Oh, thank you so much," I said, trying hard to sound like the simpering wimp he apparently thought I was. "Were you able to get in touch with the kids?"
Not yet. No answer on either phone. Probably busy with wedding stuff."
He started the Toyota and pulled out onto Winter Street.
"But that gives us all the more time to get to know each other, right?"
I couldn't fake simper my way past that dumb question, so I looked out the window and didn't answer it. "Are you planning to relocate here to Salem, Mr. Madigan?" I asked after a few seconds of silence. "In spite of your recent, unpleasantness?" "I'll start with a few little digs, then lower the boom later. This might even be fun." Surprise showed on his face for the briefest instant, but he covered it quickly with an eyes downcast expression of pure innocence.
"Oh, Lee. May I call you Lee? The darkest days of my life. I've shamed my family, my friends. I'm so blessed to have a friend like Dakota who trusts me to stand with him on the most incredibly important day in his young life."
That first blast of anger had calmed down enough so that I was beginning to question the wisdom of accepting an invitation to break bread with a man I neither liked nor trusted. "Yes," I said, "you're lucky to have faithful friends like Dakota and Shannon. I understand that Dakota thinks of you as something of a mentor. With his painting, of course." I gave him a sidelong look. "Not that other thing you do."
"Did," he stated flatly. "The thing I did. No more. Learned my lesson. Jail is not fun."
He gave a puzzled look in my direction.
"I'm beginning to think that you don't like me much, Lee."
"Maybe I'm being a little too obvious. Tone it down." "I don't mean to offend you, Mr. Madigan," I said. "All I know about you is what I read in the papers." Solemn nod.
"I understand. Can't blame you for that."
We pulled up in the parking lot next to the diner.
"Let's have a nice breakfast and talk about the wedding, the weather, the state of the union, okay? We can try to get along, if only for the sake of the kids. And that damned crow."
It was my turn to look surprised. "Poe? You don't like him. He seems like a remarkably intelligent creature."
"I'm sure he is."
Sean hurried around the car and opened my door.
"But the guest room where I'm staying at the Dumas place is right next to the aviary. Damned bird talks all night. 'Who loves you, baby? Here comes the bride. Pretty, pretty. Shiny, shiny.' Babbles on like that for hours. Seems like hours, anyway."
I ignored his proffered hand and got out of the car unaided, walking a couple of steps ahead of him toward the curvy, chrome-trimmed door leading into the vintage diner-styled restaurant. The place was uncommonly uncrowded.
"Looks like we have our choice of seats," he said. "You have a favorite spot?"
"We must be late for the early birds, and early for the breakfast regulars," I said, looking around, not seeing a single soul who looked familiar except Jenny, the waitress. "One of the small booths next to the windows will be fine." I walked ahead of him and slid onto the red vinyl-upholstered seat, being careful not to leave enough room for him to sit beside me. Jenny hurried over, handing each of us a plastic-covered menu.
"Hi, Miss Barrett. We have a nice fresh batch of those cheese Danish you like."
"I'll have one of those, Jenny, and coffee, please. Have you been here before, Mr. Madigan?" I didn't wait for an answer. Everything is good. He seemed to be studying the menu, then ordered the 2 egg, 2 pancake, 2 sausage special and coffee.
Yes, I came here after the commencement ceremony, after I missed seeing you. Had a cheeseburger. Those little pastries they served up in the Trumbull suite weren't very filling.
Another smile, this one more genuine than his previous attempts.
You missed a funny scene when the pastry chef tried to pull the tablecloth off the banquet table without disturbing the dishes.
That would be the fabulous Fabio, I said. Great baker, terrible magician. Did he break anything?
No. Fortunately, Mr. Pennington intervened in time.
Our coffees arrived, and I took a sip and decided to say what was on my mind. After all, what did I have to lose? This guy meant nothing to me. After the wedding, I'd never have to see him again. My aunt tells me that you're acquainted with her old friend, Claudine Bagenstos. I leaned forward, looking him straight in the eyes. He had brown eyes, the kind you can't see behind. Is that right? Again, the look of mild surprise, then a frown.
I've met the lady, yes. I'm surprised if she discussed our relationship with your aunt, though.
I surely didn't want Mrs. Bagenstos or my aunt to get on the wrong side of this man. I hurried to correct that impression. Oh, no. There was no discussion. My aunt happened to mention that she saw you together at lunch one day recently. That's all. He leaned back in the booth, brown eyes narrowed, body language suggesting negative feelings. About me. Maybe I'd pushed too far. It occurred to me that maybe this wasn't the kind of man one should push. My anger had suddenly been reduced to a cold, hard lump in the pit of my stomach that felt a lot like fear. I forced a happy face. So tell me, Mr. Madigan, have you ever been a best man before? Chapter 25. The remainder of that breakfast date was uncomfortable, probably for both of us. Mostly we concentrated on the food, avoiding eye contact and speaking only of, as he'd suggested, the weather, beautiful, and the wedding. A wonderfully happy occasion, and yes, this was his first experience as best man, as well as my first as maid of honor. We agreed that the food in the diner was good. We didn't discuss the State of the Union, wisely avoiding politics altogether. After what seemed like hours, but was in fact only an agonizing 45 minutes, we returned to the Toyota and started for home.
"Pretty street," he said, as we passed the Civil War monument on the corner of Winter Street. "Nice trees. One of the things I missed most in jail was the green things."
The simple statement, delivered so sincerely, surprised me. He parked in front of the house, politely walked with me to the front door, said,
"I'll see you at the wedding rehearsal,"
hurried down the steps, and drove away without a backward glance. Orion waited for me just inside the front door, as usual, and seemed extra pleased to see me. Had he been worried about me? Why not? I'd been worried about me, too. By then, though, I was no longer worried, nor angry, nor frightened. Mostly, I was confused. Was Sean Madigan a sneaky snake oil salesman? A hardened criminal? They say jail changes a person. Had he simply been behind bars so long he didn't know how annoying he was? Or were my first instincts correct? Jail or no jail, wedding or no wedding, art thief or not, I don't trust the man. I don't like him. And that's that. As I passed through the foyer on my way to the stairs, I heard the whir of a blender coming from Aunt Ibby's kitchen. I cut through the living room and the dining room, and not wanting to startle her, called her name. "Aunt Ibby, it's me. Got a minute?" The whirring stopped. "Merrily, come on out to the kitchen. I have something to show you." As soon as I rounded the corner of the dining room and stepped into the kitchen, my morning brightened. There, leaning a bit crookedly against the pantry door, was Aunt Ibby's scarecrow. "It's wonderful," I said. "Absolutely wonderful." And it was. The floppy yellow hat, accented with a few plastic roses, topped its smiling pink pillowcase face. A bright red scarf blossomed from the breast pocket, and yellow rubber gloves formed hands. She'd added red and green striped socks to the wing-tipped shoes, and the traditional straw stuffing was just enough to give an authentic look to the whole project. "Do you think he'll scare the crows?" she asked. I shook my head and laughed. "No, he's much too friendly-looking. But he'll definitely give the garden a touch of New England nostalgia. He's a beauty."
"Looks like he scared Orion."
She pointed toward the cat, who was in his belly-to-the-ground, ears-flattened crouch position. She picked him up and carried him closer to the scarecrow.
"See, big sissy cat? It's okay. He's not real."
Orion gave a genteel sniff in the direction of the red scarf, then jumped from her arms and stalked from the room.
"I'm sure he'll scare the crows, too. I'm calling him Theodore."
"You could be right," I said. "Speaking of being scared, got time to hear about my breakfast date?"
"I didn't know you had a breakfast date. Wait just a sec while I finish mixing my banana peanut butter smoothie."
She tossed a few ice cubes into the blender, and it whirred again for a moment.
"There. It's a new high-protein recipe. Would you like one?"
"Sure. Why not? I've already had breakfast twice. What harm can one more do?"
"Oh, two breakfasts? And you said something about being scared."
She poured the frothy drink into two stemmed goblets, motioned for me to sit down at the kitchen table, and took the chair opposite mine.
"Tell me all about it."
"I got a phone call this morning from Sean Madigan. He invited me to breakfast." She put her smoothie down so quickly a little of it splashed onto the table.
"I'm surprised that you accepted. You took your own car, I hope?"
"I didn't. He was so sure I'd accept that he was already parked in front of the house. Can you imagine the nerve?"
"Oh, Merrily, you must never get into a car with a stranger."
She repeated the same admonishment she'd given me when I was a teenager. I had to smile. "I know, but he was so condescending, so sure of himself. Such a phony baloney con man, he made me mad. Really mad. I just wanted to storm downstairs and put him in his place. Know what I mean?"
"I think so. Did you do it? Put him in his place, I mean."
I sipped my smoothie and thought for a few seconds. I don't know. I wasn't very nice to him, I guess.
"You said you were scared. Why?"
"You know, I'm not exactly sure. There's something intimidating about him. It wasn't so much what he said, but the way he said it." I thought back to how Sean Madigan had responded when I mentioned Claudine Bagenstose. I mentioned that you'd seen him with Mrs. Bagenstose, and his reaction gave me a chill.
"Did he seem angry? Annoyed? What?"
"He was cold. Polite and cold. I hope he doesn't call me again."
"I hope he doesn't, too. Look, Orion's back."
She patted her lap. The big cat approached, giving the scarecrow a wide berth before accepting her invitation to join us at the table.
"He still doesn't like Theodore, though."
"I know how he feels," I said. "Orion doesn't believe that polite smile. He knows that inside Theodore is a big fake." I thought about telling her that I'd had another vision. I looked at the kitchen clock. If I was going to do all the things I had planned and still show up on time at WICH-TV, I needed to get going. "I'm going to do a little investigating today," I said. I gave her a quick rundown of my plans to visit the scenes of the tree strippings and asked permission to mention her name when I introduced myself to Claudine Bagenstose.
"Of course you can, and do give my love to Claudine. By the way, have you told Pete yet about your encounter with the Madigan person?"
"No, I came right here. I'll tell him tonight.
He's bringing champagne to celebrate my new career.
He's not going to be pleased.
Maybe I overreacted. Maybe I shouldn't have been so angry. Anyway, right now I need to go and change into something more presentable. I said, then added, and for some reason, I feel like taking another shower. Chapter 26. I decided to try for a business-like look for my impromptu interviews. I selected an ivory two-piece silk shantung outfit I'd bought on sale at Nordstrom's and hadn't had a chance to wear yet. Low heels were in order if I was going to be stomping around in other people's backyards, so I wore brown flats. After twisting my hair into a reasonably neat chignon, I added pearl earrings, tucked pen and notebook into my favorite Kate Spade handbag, and I was good to go. I headed for North Salem, consulting Google for directions to Southwick Street, an L-shaped street just off Dearborn that made the Baginstows and Tasker households almost neighbors. I'd had a glimpse of Gloria's house in her neighbor's video and of her backyard in my vision. Neither one did justice to the real thing. "The best house in the neighborhood," Aunt Ibby had said, and it appeared to be true. A neat white picket fence surrounded a perfectly manicured lawn. Bushes were trimmed into rounded shapes, and bright tulips marched along a paved path, leading to a beautiful little Cape Cod cottage, its silvery weathered shingles and blue shutters completing a real estate agent's dream of curb appeal. The only jarring note was the quince tree, its bare, bone-like branches a stark contrast to the perfection of the picture. I parked next to a U-Haul with Nevada plates, made sure my notebook was in my purse, and approached the front door. I pressed the doorbell, smiling when I heard the chimes play "Fly Me to the Moon." "Be right there," came a voice from inside, followed by a brief interval of barking. The blue door opened just enough for me to see a woman with short salt-and-pepper hair and brown eyes, and enough for a very large Doberman to stick his head through. "Hello," said the woman in a friendly way. "Can I help you?" "Hello," I said, handing one of my brand-new WICH-TV business cards through the opening. "I'm Lee Barrett, WICH-TV. I wonder if you have time to speak with me for a few minutes about your cousin?" Accepting the card, she pulled the door open wider and poked her head out, looking toward the driveway.
"I don't see no cameras," she said.
The dog, seeing an opportunity to get out, ran into the yard and rolled happily in the lush grass.
"Come back here, Zeus," she called,
shoving my card into the pocket of what Aunt Ibby calls a cobbler's apron. She clapped her hands.
"You naughty boy."
Zeus stopped rolling and walked very slowly, head down toward his mistress, then sat obediently on the top step. She rewarded him with a treat from one of several apron pockets.
"Good dog."
She patted his head, then turned toward me.
"Now, what were you saying, honey? Something about Gloria?"
I repeated my name. "I'm an investigative reporter for WICH-TV. It was the first time I'd introduced myself with the title in a face-to-face situation, and it sounded strange, even to me.
"Oh, yeah, sure. I don't know how much help I can be. I hadn't seen her for years. Want to come in? I'm Gloria's cousin, Jane, trying to pack up her stuff to take back home. She left everything to me."
She pushed the door open.
"It's not that we were big buds or anything. It turns out I'm the closest living relative she had. Our mothers were sisters."
She pulled my card from her pocket and looked at it.
"Lee Barrett." "Okay, Lee, come on in. We can talk while I finish packing up dishes."
She held the door open.
"Come on, Zeus."
The dog followed me inside. The house was just as attractive inside as it was on the exterior, even with packing boxes stacked on the floor and piled onto tables and chairs. I followed Jane through a living room decorated in muted blues and grays. Crisp white organdy curtains fluttered at an open window, framing a view of pink and white hollyhocks outside. "It's a lovely home," I said, as we emerged into a Martha Stewart-worthy kitchen. Are you planning to sell it?
Jane opened a cabinet door and pulled a step stool into position so she could reach the top shelf.
Oh, she didn't leave me the house, just the things in it.
She lifted a teapot from the shelf and lowered it carefully to the counter.
You drink tea? You can have this if you want.
Thanks anyway. It's beautiful, but I'm a coffee fiend. I'll probably never use it. Anyway, it's too valuable to just give away.
I won't use it either. Not my style.
She sighed.
I'm just getting tired of packing. She had some really pretty things. Top quality. You should see her jewelry. I'm pretty sure it's all real.
I'm supposed to be asking questions about Gloria. Never mind the teapots and trinkets. Your cousin had lovely taste, I said. Jane nodded solemnly.
She liked expensive things, but thank goodness she didn't leave me any bills. Her funeral was even prepaid, and one of those societies that cremates the body and puts the ashes in the ocean took care of all that.
I wrote, Gloria was cremated, returned to the earth. Jane wrapped porcelain plates in newspaper before placing them into a box.
I guess she made a good living waitressing. She always sent my kids nice presents at Christmas.
I remembered what Aunt Ibby had said about Gloria only liking to wait on the businessmen, the big tippers. My aunt remembered your cousin. She told me Gloria was an excellent waitress.
Well, she did say that, right after she called Gloria a witch.
I scribbled, generous to young relatives. Did you know about Gloria's, religion?
You mean the witchcraft thing? I had no freaking idea. Our mothers must be rolling over, but my kids think it's the coolest thing they ever heard.
How do you feel about it? She wrapped a teacup slowly, looking thoughtful.
You know, I don't mind it. If it made her happy, it's perfectly okay with me. I just hope that's not what got her killed.
She put the cup into a box.
What do you think? Is somebody killing witches? That's what you're investigating, isn't it?
The question surprised me, though I suppose it shouldn't have. I had, after all, told her I was an investigative reporter. I'm doing a report on the crows, I said. My next question was going to be about the quince tree.
God, it looks so ugly like that. If it were up to me, I'd chop the thing down, but like I told you, I don't own the place.
She wrapped a stack of saucers one by one.
It would have made Gloria sad, though. She was proud of that tree. Sent me a couple of jars of homemade quince jelly every year.
I made a note to mention Gloria's quince jelly. Were you here when the crows did it? Stripped the tree?
I was right here in the house. I heard all the commotion. That awful screechy noise they make about drove poor Zeus crazy.
The dog acknowledged his name by moving close to Jane. She reached down and patted his head.
He barked and whined the whole time. He finally went and tried to hide under Gloria's bed. I watched the whole thing from the window. Say, if you want to see a picture of it, that nosy old bat next door was making a movie of the whole thing.
No kidding! How do you know?
She's not very good at hiding it. She just holds the camera right on top of the fence. I guess she does it a lot. The lady who lives on the other side of her told me the camera is aimed at her yard just about every time she goes outside to work in her garden.
She shrugged.
I was going to call the cops on the woman, but everybody around here says she's harmless. It's not like she puts the stuff up on YouTube or anything.
I wouldn't like it, I admitted, a little ashamed that I'd already used some of the illicitly obtained footage. I think I'd probably tell her to stop or I'd report her for snooping.
Oh, well.
Jane sealed the box with a wide strip of tape.
I won't be here much longer. Maybe somebody should tell the next tenant.
She opened another cabinet.
I wonder sometimes, though, how many videos she's shot of Gloria's goings-on.
I wonder, too. I guess you know that the crows stripped another tree in the neighborhood, I said.
You mean the Baggins-Joses apple tree?
Jane pulled several cake pans from the shelf and put them on the counter.
These can go to Goodwill. I have enough pots and pans. Unless you can use them?
No, thanks. Do you know Mrs. Baggins-Jose?
Not really. She saw the U-Haul and stopped by to say hello. I guess you must have known Gloria. I showed her the tree, and she said hers had been stripped exactly the same way. I'm going to go over to her house after I leave here. I hope she'll talk to me. She's really nice. Awfully sad, though, because of her husband dying like he did. Did you know he was picking a branch with buds on it as a surprise for her? She wanted to try forcing blossoms in warm water, like you can do with forsythia. I didn't know that. What a sweet story. I'll ask her to tell me about it. Thanks, Jane. You're welcome, Lee. When is your show going to be on? It's not really my show, just a segment on the late news. It's tonight. I'll be on with Buck Covington. Ooh, lucky you. He's a real doll. Yes, he's good-looking all right. Thanks for your time, Jane. Sorry for the loss of your cousin. I patted Zeus, who gave my hand a friendly lick. I'll let you get back to your packing. You're welcome. Zeus likes you. Do you have a dog? No, I have a cat, though. His name is Orion. We have a cat, too. I had to leave her home, but I brought Zeus along to keep me company. Gloria didn't have any pets. Although there's a cute stray black cat who's been hanging around ever since I got here. I've been putting out saucers of milk for her once in a while. That's nice. My aunt and I like to feed strays, too. Thanks for talking with me. And please give me a call if you think of anything to add to what we've talked about, or if the crows come back. God forbid, she said. Jane and Zeus escorted me to the front door and watched as I walked down the path to my car. As I unlocked the vet, I looked back, once again noting how the bare branches of the quince tree clashed with the perfection of the house and grounds. The small black cat moved so quickly, if I had blinked I would have missed seeing her. She peeked from behind the trunk, then ducked back behind it, as though she were playing hide-and-seek with me. I waved to her, and, still smiling, headed for Dearborn Street. Chapter 27 The Bagginstow's house was very different from the little Cape Cod I'd just left. It was an imposing mansion set well back from the street, with a tall wrought iron fence surrounding a lush front lawn. Flowering bushes and several trees dotted the landscaped property. It was every bit as lovingly maintained as the Tasker property was, just a heck of a lot bigger. A gate closed off the driveway. I opened my window and pressed the indicated button. "Name, please," requested an automated voice. "Lee Barrett," I said, "WICH-TV, to see Mrs. Bagginstow's. I don't have an appointment." The voice didn't reply, but the gate swung open, so I drove slowly toward the house. Should I go to the front door? Or did media people use a servant's entrance in the Bagginstow's world? I parked in front of what appeared to be a four-car garage and climbed out of the vet. The question of where to go from there was answered when the front door opened, and a woman stepped out onto a wide granite terrace. She paused for a moment, then, smiling broadly, walked toward me.
"Lee? Lee Barrett? You're Ribby Russell's niece. I remember when you were a little girl, and your aunt used to bring you into Elliot's bank."
She was tall, with steel-gray, shoulder-length hair asymmetrically cut. She wore a short black dress, which, as she drew closer, I recognized as vintage French lace, probably 1920s. It was what collectors call a flapper dress. And while it was certainly attractive on her slim figure, it struck me as an odd choice of clothing for mid-afternoon in Salem. I didn't remember the early childhood bank visits at all, but accepted a hug and air kiss. "Thanks so much for seeing me, Mrs. Bagginstow's." I handed her my card. I know I should have called, but it was a spur-of-the-moment idea. I'm doing a report on the crows for the station, and I understand you've had an unfortunate experience with them.
"A dreadful experience. Simply dreadful."
She held the door open and motioned for me to enter.
"Come in, dear child. I'll tell you all about it."
The foyer was carpeted with an exquisite oriental rug in red tones.
Mrs. Bagginstos tossed my card into a silver tray atop a Bombay chest with gold drawer pulls. Rows of paintings lined the walls.
"Like a museum," my aunt had told me.
She wasn't kidding. The woman directed me into a large, fireplaced room that I'd call a parlor. Massive furniture, another oriental rug, this one in tones of blue, and more paintings. I resisted the urge to gawk around like a tourist at the Louvre, and, notebook and pen in hand, I sat in the gilt-carved Louis XV armchair she indicated. She sat facing me in a matching chair, arranging the short lace skirt over slim legs. According to my aunt, Claudine Bagginstos was in her early 60s. If that was true, she was maintaining her looks extremely well.
"It was the apple tree," she began. "But I'm sure you know that. It was in the newspaper and on television, too. The crows came in a great black cloud one afternoon and descended on the poor, dear tree."
She produced a handkerchief from somewhere and dabbed at her eyes.
"Elliot loved that tree. It was just beginning to bud, you know."
"Were you here when it happened?" I asked, pen poised. "Did you see the crows?"
"Not at first," she said. "One of the maids called to me to come to the window. I heard them before I saw them. They make such horrible noises. Filthy creatures."
"But you saw them destroying your tree," I prompted.
"It only took them a few minutes. They devoured everything. Leaves, buds, everything. Then they rose up in a big black cloud and disappeared."
"Disappeared?"
"It seemed so to me," she said. "They were there, then poof, they were gone. I'm glad my darling Elliot wasn't here to see such destruction. It was his favorite tree. Did I tell you that?"
"Yes. I spoke earlier with Ms. Tasker's cousin. She told me a very touching story about your husband selecting a branch from that tree for you."
"It's true."
She dabbed at her eyes again.
"That dear man's very last act on this earth was something to please me. He must have climbed on that shaky old ladder to get a branch, a spray of apple blossoms to put in my pink vase."
She waved a French-tipped manicured hand toward the fireplace.
"There's my pink vase on the mantel," she said, "right beside the urn holding my darling's ashes."
I hoped she was planning to return his ashes to the earth per Wiccan teachings, but didn't comment on that. "Would you tell me the story about the apple blossoms?" I said. "I'd like to share it with the viewers of WICH-TV. "Please say yes. If there's anything Mr. Doan likes better than blood, it's pathos." She hesitated and glanced around the room.
"Oh, I don't know. The only person I've mentioned it to was Jane, that poor woman's cousin. It was quite a personal moment."
"I understand," I said. "I really do." She put the handkerchief aside and stiffened her posture.
"I believe you do," she said. "So I'll tell you how it happened. We'd had breakfast together as usual. Cook had prepared a lovely spinach omelet, and we had our morning coffee afterward on the patio overlooking the backyard. It was the housekeeper's day off, and Cook was going to market. So Elliot and I were looking forward to a quiet day together."
She dabbed at her eyes with a lace-edged handkerchief.
"It looks as though the tree is about to blossom, darling," he said.
She leaned forward and dropped her voice.
"I told him I'd love to have a branch or two to put into warm water so we could watch it blossom indoors. I didn't think about it again that morning. Then, later, I happened to look out the window, and I saw that the ladder had tipped over."
She looked down at the rug and grew silent. I waited for her to finish. She looked up.
"I ran outside. He was on the ground. I don't know how long he'd been lying there. I held him in my arms and told him I loved him. He was cold. I knew he'd already gone to be with the Lord. His last act in this world was to cut that lovely budding branch for me."
Her eyes glistened with tears, and she touched them with the handkerchief once more. "It's a beautiful story," I told her, I'd be proud to share it with my viewers with your permission.
Of course you may, my dear, she said,
then looked at her watch, a Rolex with a diamond pave face.
I'm sorry. Time has slipped away. You must excuse me. I have an appointment shortly.
I put my notebook away and stood. She ushered me politely but firmly toward the foyer.
It was a joy to see you, my dear. I'll try to stay awake to watch your program. I'm usually sound asleep by that time, though. Give my love to your dear aunt.
Thank you so much for seeing me today, I said. Perhaps someday you'll allow me to interview you about your wonderful antiques. I know the viewers would be fascinated.
I'd be delighted to do that, dear. Someday, after my grief has lessened.
She opened the door, and I stepped out onto the terrace.
Bye-bye now, she said,
and did a little girl twirl back into her house, lace flapper dress flaring. I headed to my car, then realized that I hadn't seen the apple tree. She'd said it was in the backyard, and I thought it would be okay if I just took a quick look behind the garage. I hurried along the edge of the long building, and there it was. It was bigger than the quince tree and much taller, which made the winter-like leaflessness all the more startling. There were other trees nearby, green and healthy, some of them bearing fragrant white blossoms. I wished then that I'd brought Therese along with her camera. It would have been good TV. I stood there quietly, thinking of Elliot Bagginstos's last sad moments. I didn't hear the man approach from behind me until he spoke.
So, we meet twice on the same day. What a surprise.
I'm sure I jumped. Mr. Madigan, I stammered. Hello? He wasn't smiling. I took a step backward.
What are you doing?
The question was asked in a polite tone of voice, but the look on his face was chilling. I began to answer, I was just... when I felt the tiniest flare of temper begin to rise. It's none of your damned business. I'm looking at the apple tree, I said flatly. Why do you ask?
This isn't a good place for you to be, he said.
Chapter 28
Sean Madigan's tone was no longer polite, or even friendly.
Goodbye now. Have a nice day, he said,
eyes narrowed, voice cold. I had a strong feeling that he was right. This wasn't a good place for me to be. I didn't reply, just walked a little faster on my way back to my car. That's when a window on the side of the garage gave me a glimpse of the green Toyota parked inside, next to a pair of shiny, matching black his-and-hers Cadillacs. What the hell is going on here? When I told Pete about Aunt Ibby seeing Sean and Claudine Bagginstos together, he'd said,
We're keeping an eye on that situation.
What situation was he talking about? What did the widow and the art crook have going on that raided him access to her garage? Was the appointment she'd mentioned with him? It certainly looked that way to me. I peeled out of the driveway onto Dearborn Street, then slowed down to a more decorous pace on the way to North Street and home. I tried to concentrate on the new notes I'd taken about the two stripped trees, to think about the behaviors of crows, to organize my thoughts, and focus on show prep for my debut broadcast just hours away. By the time I pulled into my own garage, I still hadn't entirely succeeded in erasing intruding images of the art thief slash best man virtually chasing me away from the Bagginstos place, but just being home again gave a sense of security, of safety. So did being greeted at the door with purrs and loving ankle rubs from our wise and loyal cat. I picked up Orion, pressed my face into soft fur, and carried him all the way up the two flights to my apartment. Such pampering was an infrequent occurrence. He clearly enjoyed it, and rewarded me with dainty, pink-tongued licks to my chin. Once inside the kitchen, I released the cat, tossed the notebook onto the table, kicked off my shoes, turned on Mr. Coffee, and prepared to do some last-minute organizing of information. I didn't plan to count on the teleprompter, but had decided to make a few backup notes to keep me on track. After about an hour of condensing, combining, and sorting the various pieces of information I'd gathered about crows in general, and Salem's recent murder of crows in particular, along with the human interest angles I'd picked up from Jane and Mrs. Bagginstose, I was confident that I had material for a good, tight, entertaining 15 minutes of airtime. I stacked my notes, leaned back in my chair, drained my coffee cup, and looked at Kit Kat Clock. I'd had a busy day, most of it positive, some of it downright weird. There was still plenty of time for a well-deserved nap before dinner. Then I'd be off to the station, where Wanda, the Weather Girl's personal hair and makeup guy, had promised to work his magic on me before I appeared on camera. I exchanged the silk shantung for my Minnie Mouse nightshirt, set my alarm for 7 o'clock, and pulled on a pink satin eye mask I'd used for day sleeping back when I hosted nightshades. I crawled between the covers and was sound asleep within what seemed like seconds. A sound awakened me. I lay quietly for a moment, puzzled because it wasn't the expected monotonous buzz-buzz of my bedside alarm clock. More like a scritch, scritch. I lifted the eye mask just enough to see the clock face. 6:10. I slid the mask up onto my forehead, sat up in bed, and listened. Nothing. Whatever it was that woke me up had gone silent. I sat up, stretched, took off the mask, and put both feet on the floor, still listening. Still nothing. "Must have been dreaming, or imagining things," I said aloud, then looked around for Orion so I wouldn't feel so silly about talking to myself. "Are you here, Cat?" A soft meow from the kitchen answered my question. Then Orion appeared in my doorway, head cocked in his "What's up?" position. "Did you hear that?" I asked. "That scratchy noise. Did you do it?" He turned around, facing into the kitchen, then looked back at me. "Okay, I'm coming." Barefoot, I followed. He climbed onto the windowsill, sat on his haunches, nose against the pane. It was still light outside, that pretty late afternoon kind of golden light that happens sometimes before dusk. I pulled up a kitchen chair and sat directly behind him and peered over his fuzzy head. "What are you looking at? Did that sound come from outdoors?" I didn't have to look far, and I didn't have to listen hard for the scratchy noise. The answer was right in front of me. Literally. I've heard crow's eyes described as beady, and the term is accurate. A crow's eye close up looks just like a round, shiny black bead. And this one was definitely close up. So was this crow's foot, long, black, sharp talons, scratching rhythmically on the screen. "I hope it doesn't think I'm going to let it into the house," I told Orion, who seemed to be taking the presence of this intruder on his turf remarkably calmly. "What does it want?" The creature stopped scratching and bobbed its head forward, beak open. Picked up something shiny from the fire escape and dropped it on the outer sill. Then it repeated the action. Some of the sources I consulted said crows like shiny objects and have been known to steal them. Was this visiting crow a thief, depositing stolen goods at my kitchen window? The thing lifted its wings, which made the already oversized bird look even more gigantic. It headed toward Oliver Street, not stopping at the maple tree, but wheeling high above it and disappearing into darkening blue sky. Naturally, I was curious to see what this visitor had left for me, but mostly I wondered why it had left me anything. Thoughts of Peg Wesson and Bridget Bishop popped into my head, Legend had it that each of them could turn into crows, among other creatures. Was I seeing a recycled witch scratching at my window? I shook away the silly thought, lifted the screen, and retrieved two shiny brass cylinders. I recognized them immediately. Shell casings. I held them in my palm, then turned one over. 380 Auto was incised on the base. 380 Auto. Wasn't that the caliber of the bullets the police had dug out of Christopher Rich's magic store wall? Oh, boy. Had I just destroyed fingerprints on evidence? I opened a kitchen drawer with one hand, removed a plastic zippered bag, and dropped the casings into it. Why had the crow brought these particular casings to me? I didn't know the answer to that, but I was pretty sure Pete would want to know about it. Okay, so I call my straight arrow, nothing but the facts, ma'am, police detective boyfriend, and say something like, "Hi, Pete, listen, this big crow came to my window. I mean, I think it's a crow, but it could be a witch in disguise. But anyway, it left me something on my windowsill." No, not poop. It was two shell casings. You want to see them? I shook my head, closed the screen, picked up my phone, and hit Pete's private number. He answered right away.
"Hi, babe. I bought the champagne for tonight. Are you all ready for your first report?"
"I am, but, Pete, I called about something else. Something strange has happened. Did you ever find the shell casings from the gun used to shoot at Christopher Rich?"
"Not yet. Why?"
"I think I may have them. Somebody, something, left them here. I don't know why, but I'm pretty sure they're the ones you're looking for."
"I think maybe I should come over. Okay?"
He sounded confused, and who could blame him? "I have to leave for the station pretty soon. Hair and makeup, you know," I said. "If I'm not here, the casings are in a plastic bag on the counter. Anyway, I'll see you after the show. Maybe by then I'll come up with a sensible way to explain this. If there is a sensible way." I made a peanut butter sandwich and poured a glass of milk. I didn't feel like having dinner, and I wanted to be gone before Pete arrived. My on-air outfit was ready in a garment bag. I pulled my hair back with a wide band and cleaned my face carefully, as per instructions from Wanda's makeup guru. I ate most of the sandwich, gulped down the milk, donned jeans and sweatshirt, grabbed my notes and the garment bag, and hurried down the back stairs. As I backed out of the driveway, I looked up at the maple tree branches. About half a dozen crows looked back at me. When I pulled into the WICH-TV Harborside parking lot, I couldn't resist looking up into the oak tree on the Essex Street side of the property. More crows, all quietly watching. I guessed there might be around a dozen there, and it seemed as though those shiny, shoe-button eyes watched as I walked to the front steps. Rhonda was still at her desk when I arrived at WICH-TV. "You're early," she said. "I stuck around to watch Carmine, do you?"
"Carmine? The makeup guy?"
"Yep. He says he can hardly wait. Loves your red hair, your bone structure, your eyes. Says you're a blank canvas, just waiting for an artist like him."
"I'm a blank canvas?"
Not quite sure I liked the analogy. I followed Rhonda through the soundproof door leading to the first floor broadcast studios. As we passed the glass-enclosed newsroom, it occurred to me that, even though I'd been on-air talent for WICH-TV in the past, I'd never yet worked in that rarefied setting. Nightshades had been shot in a small set in the downstairs studio, across from the Cooking with Wanda the Weather Girl kitchen. So this night would mark the beginning of what might turn into a new career for me. Lee Barrett, news reporter. Who knows, maybe even Lee Barrett, news anchor. Blank canvas, indeed. The makeup room had been greatly improved in the time I'd been away from the station. Real salon-type chairs, big, well-lighted mirror,
shampoo station, and shelves of beauty products. Naturally, everything was done in varying shades of purple, but in this environment, it seemed to fit. The man standing beside a lavender marble counter, where an assortment of combs and brushes were displayed, rubbed his hands together when Rhonda and I entered the room.
"Miss Barrett, you cannot imagine how delighted I am to have this opportunity."
"This is Carmine Lee," Rhonda said, giving me a gentle push in his direction. "Carmine, here she is. Lee Barrett, work your magic."
She sat on a white wicker chair with a purple velvet cushion.
"Mind if I watch?"
He nodded in Rhonda's direction, then wordlessly took my hand and led me to the violet chair in front of the mirror. He pushed a button, and a beam of light illuminated every pore, every blemish, every stray eyebrow hair, every line on my face. I even saw wrinkles on my neck that I'd never seen before. I closed my eyes, tight. "Ugh," I said.
"Ah," he said. "What a face. Those cheekbones, those lips, those eyes, that complexion, and the hair. Glorious."
He began work with cool, creamy stuff evenly spread over my face and neck. I dared to open my eyes, then quickly shut them again.
"We'll let the cleanser work while I shampoo," he said.
As I reclined, head over the sink, he massaged wonderful-smelling things into my hair. Darn near fell asleep. Towel dry, then back to the mirror, where he patted my face gently with a soft, warm cloth. I dared to peek at the mirror. My skin looked better already. Note to self, buy a barrel of that face cream.
"Now for the hair."
He ran skilled fingers through the curly mess.
"Maybe a little trim? A bit of straightening? Tiny highlights?"
I don't know. Highlights?
Rhonda's, "Absolutely. Go for it, Lee," drowned out my hesitant,
"Maybe." Again, I closed my eyes. It would have been a totally relaxing experience, except for thoughts of the window-scratching crow, the brass bullet casings, and the most worrying question of all. How am I supposed to explain all that to Pete?
Chapter 29. I kept my eyes shut as Carmine worked. I've never been very good at hair. I wash and condition regularly, have it trimmed once in a while, and do the best I can with a comb and brush. I also have a good-sized collection of bad hair day hats. I heard the snip-snip of scissors and felt some gentle tugging here and there. It was all so relaxing, I nearly dozed off.
"A few minutes under the dryer now, Miss Barrett."
I dared another look at the mirror. Sections of hair were wrapped in foil, spiking outward like Medusa's snakes. With a silent prayer that this guy knew what he was doing, I obediently took a seat under a lavender dome. The dryer time gave me a few minutes to think. To plot, really. I needed to tell Pete the truth about how the shell casings had appeared at my window. But to explain the crow, I'd have to first make sure he was familiar with some local witch legends, like the ones about Peg Wesson and Bridget Bishop, those naughty little shapeshifters. This isn't going to be easy. The police are going to want to know where I got the casings. I can tell Pete about the crow and just hope he'll understand, but I'm not sure the chief will buy it. Maybe Pete will tell him someone put them there. The thoughts were disturbing. How did someone get to the third floor window? I answered my own question. It's impossible. The company that installed the fire escape guaranteed that although there's a sliding ladder leading from the second floor platform to the ground, it only works one way. Down. Maybe I imagined the crow. Maybe it was a crow vision appearing on window glass. Such a thing had happened before,
Once a vision in a window showed me a bear. But an imaginary crow couldn't carry real shell casings. What if it wasn't impossible for someone to climb up to my window? That idea gave me a chill. It would mean